listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, on CRN in cable systems across the country, and simulcast as TV by the Free Speech TV Network on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide. More people watch or listen to this program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. So it is a great honor to be here and to hang out with you, and boy, is there a lot going on. By the way, we had a great time in Vermont last week. I'll fill you in on some of that as we go on. And prayers going to the Supreme Court, and another kid gets killed with a handgun. More of that in a few minutes. But right now, David Schuster is with us. He is the executive editor at TakeActionNews.com, the host of Take Action News with David Schuster on We Act Radio, WPWC, 1480 AM. In Washington, D.C., which also carries our show, TakeActionNews.com, the website. David, welcome back.
Oh, Tom, it's always a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
It is always a pleasure and an honor to have you with us. So over the weekend, my understanding, I was on a plane much of this weekend, and I missed the original, but I saw the replay of it. In fact, here's just a little clip. Jennifer Rubin apparently went off on you about this whole Benghazi thing. Let me just play this clip.
You're speaking on behalf of the administration.
David, Jennifer.
Very nice to have the media the Media Matters talking points recited out of David's
What are you talking
but,
about?
That is
said medium. What are you talking about, Jane?
Howard, if Jennifer, you want to hear me, that's fine. If you don't, you should mute
me. Let's Media Matters today.
Let's assume that everybody is giving their own views. You may disagree with them.
So what was going on?
Well, I'm not sure because, I don't have any contact with Media Matters. I mean, I got a couple friends over there, but if they have talking points, it's unaware to me. I was just, giving the analysis that Benghazi, the Republican theory about Benghazi had completely fallen apart with ABC's reporting being wrong last week. And Jennifer, for whatever reason, I guess, decided that instead of arguing with me about that, she had to throw in something about Media Matters, which I didn't quite understand. And then in the midst of that, if you play it twice, we'll hear her asking how he Kurtz to mute me so that she can talk. And in all the years that I've been doing television, I've never had a guest with the psychotic view that somehow she can turn to the host and say, hey, mute that other guy so I can speak. I mean, it's pretty lame and weak stuff.
Well, before we get into the substance of this, just FYI, if you didn't, and maybe you probably do know this, but Media Matters is a bugbear over at Fox. Media Matters has, which David Brock founded, has been openly outing Fox virtually on a daily basis for lies that they tell for several years now. To the point that people on Fox are starting, at least they were. I don't watch that much Fox. I haven't watched much of it at all in the last 6 months or a year. But a couple of years ago, there was a year or so there where they were on a fairly regular basis trying to trash Media Matters or diminish their credibility because Media Matters was doing such a good job of outing their lies and their distortions. So I think this was on CNN that you were having this dialogue. I think what she was doing was shouting out to the Fox viewers. The Fox viewers knew immediately. As soon as she said Media Matters, it meant that you were a lefty, commie, pinko, liberal, in with George Soros, all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's like those two words just have a whole universe of meaning to people who watch Fox.
Well, I would have preferred that you just call me all of those things. I mean, the fact of the matter is that Media Matters, if they have talking points, I'll take their talking points over any news organization in town. I mean, they've got a research team. David Brock has done an amazing job of making sure that what they put out is 100% accurate. And that's why, of course, Fox News and conservatives hate them so much, because Media Matters monitors all the garbage that the conservative media is spewing out and corrects them on it. And so, for whatever reason, I suppose because there's so much sensitivity at Fox News and the likes of Jennifer Rubin about being constantly told, oh, you have to get it right, that they want to lash out at Media Matters as opposed to look at their own reporting and try to correct things.
Now, speaking of their reporting, I'm assuming that you saw this piece by Sarah Jones about the Joy Reid dropping this little gem. She said that a trusted source told her to look at the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs And there's only one member of that committee who is also a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And of the Republicans on that committee, that's Tom Coburn, John McCain, Rob Johnson, Rob Portman, Rand Paul, Mike Enzi, and Kelly Ayotte. The only one who's also a member of the Select Committee on Intelligence is Tom Coburn. And he, the day before ABC ran this story containing these heavily edited emails from the White House, and edited isn't even the wrong word. I mean, somebody had taken actual White House emails and inserted words into them to make it look like they said something they didn't about protecting the State Department and protecting Hillary Clinton. And it was Tom Coburn who was on Morning Joe on May 9th saying there are glaring omissions in what had been given to the Intelligence Committee. In other words, he had apparently seen these phony Republican doctored emails that were being shopped around Capitol Hill and that were ultimately picked up by that, Sarah Jones refers to as the gullible rube Jonathan Carl over at ABC, as well as the Weekly Standard and CBS. What do you think? What's your take on what's going on here? It seems like this is the real scandal, that the Republicans are shopping phony versions, rewritten versions of White House emails.
Well, it's interesting because Senator Coburn gets to something that has come out, and that is that, you know, Congress had the original emails from the White House back in March. They had all the emails from the administration, and there was nothing there. And that's why we didn't hear about them, because there was no evidence in the emails of the White House massaging or changing talking points to try to protect anybody. And so, you know, there was common knowledge back then. All of a sudden, Jonathan Carl gets fed some, you know, bogus emails that have all sorts of things in them that the original emails didn't. And all of a sudden, you've got members of the Senate saying, wait a second, maybe either the emails that Jonathan Carl has are the real emails, and what we've been given by the administration were changed or edited. And so all of a sudden, these Republican staffers, in an effort to try to hoodwink Jonathan Carl, suddenly they've got more power and they've got members of the Senate convinced the Obama administration has held something back, when in fact the Obama administration turned this stuff over. And as you've reported, I mean, the key Republican talking point in all of this has been that somehow the White House after Benghazi changed or edited the talking points to protect Hillary Clinton, to protect the State Department. But in fact, the emails show nothing of the sort. The emails show that the White House was agreeing with the State Department and the CIA, and was simply, that everybody was simply saying, well, wait a second, because there's an ongoing investigation, we don't know exactly who is responsible, let's hold back right now so we don't put out false information.
And right. They were just trying to get the truth out as much as they knew the truth, and avoid speculation, particularly speculation that might compromise intelligence. That's pretty clear. Isn't, David, we have just a minute left. Isn't the real scandal right now, and isn't the real question that we should be asking, who was the Republican who rewrote the White House emails and released them to ABC News and the Weekly Standard? And what did Tom Coburn know, and when did he know it?
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, Jonathan Carl said over the weekend he regretted some of the mistakes. He didn't apologize, but he has not gone out and characterized who the source is. And CBS News has come out and said, oh, the source was a Republican or group of Republicans in Capitol Hill. That's farther than ABC News has gone. And ABC News has a responsibility and an obligation right now to say, okay, here's who these sources were. If they don't want to identify them, at least characterize them so that all of us, this is a story that Republicans
right.
are out there trying
who
to...
Who lied to ABC News? And shouldn't the Democrats in the Senate be doing the same thing that Darrell Issa is doing, only about an honest issue? Shouldn't they be holding hearings to try and find out?
I would call Jonathan Carl as a witness and say, look, you got it wrong. Identify your story.
There you go. Harry Reid, get on this right now. David Schuster, executive editor of TakeActionNews.com and host of the Take Action News Show with David Schuster on WEAC Radio, WPWC, 1480 AM in Washington, D.C. David, always great to have you on. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Take care.
Keep up the great work.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
David Schuster, one of the great voices in the media. We'll be back at 16 minutes past the hour. Talk media for the rest of us. This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. And money is not speech either. It's property. And let us not forget that. A two-year-old boy in Asheboro, North Carolina. These are two amazing stories back to back on the same block, on the same news block over at Democratic Underground, Rob posts this. The first, a two-year-old boy in Asheboro. These are both North Carolina stories from over the weekend or from the last couple of days. A two-year-old boy was accidentally shot when the toddler found an unsecured handgun at his home in Spring Valley Road, just outside Asheboro city limits. The family, mom, dad, and three older siblings were at home at the time. The child saw the handgun in the parent's bedroom, put it in his mouth where it went off. And I get these guys calling in the show, oh, yeah, I got a gun, and I keep it in my bedroom, and my kids know not to go in there. They know the danger. And I tell the story of when I was 7 years old. At that point, I think three of my four younger brothers were born, and we had a babysitter. And, of course, we broke into my parents' bedroom when the babysitter was there, and we found a box of condoms next to, you know, in the drawer next to the bed, and we didn't know what they were. We thought they were really cool balloons, and we were out in the front yard with five or six of these condoms blown up to be like 3 feet long and a foot in diameter and bouncing them around in the air. When my dad and my mom pulled up in their car and were pretty horrified. But, you know, to think that kids aren't going to find things just because they're in dad's bedroom? Come on. Okay, so that's half of the story. The other half of the story, the same North Carolina, same state. North Carolina House passes Save the Gun Bill. State House lawmakers voted Wednesday to forbid law enforcement officers, from destroying fully operating firearms, even if they're used in a crime. Judges would no longer have the authority to order the destruction of a weapon confiscated in a criminal case. Now, I'm not sure that there's an equivalent in Christianity. I think in Christianity it's okay to, like, just kind of toss your Bible in the trash. It's disrespectful, but it's not, you know, a sin, to the best of my knowledge. In Judaism, the Torah is, you know, I mean, the only way you can dispose of it is to bury it. I believe in Islam, it's the same thing with the Quran. I mean, they're considered holy. They're sacred. And so you can't just destroy them. You have to do it with an appropriate way. You have to have a burial, literally. An appropriate burial. Well, they're doing the same thing now with firearms. They're saying they're sacred. This is House Bill 714 that was passed the House last Wednesday in the state house in Raleigh, North Carolina. It says, if a firearm is fully functioning and still has a legible identification number, sheriffs and other law enforcement officers cannot destroy it regardless of its background. So you can't destroy the Quran or the Torah, but you can, and you can't destroy firearms in North Carolina. It hasn't been made law yet. It's just passed one. It hasn't passed the Senate yet or been signed by the governor, but this is the direction they're going. Meanwhile, SCOTUS coming, or SCROTUS. The Supreme Court agreed to hear Greece, New York versus Galloway. Now, what's happened here is that the Establishment Clause of the Constitution reads, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And this town, Greece, New York, it's a little town in upstate New York, near Rochester. Since 1999, they've begun their town meetings with a prayer. And Susan Galloway and Lyndon Stevens challenged those as a violation of the Establishment Clause. In other words, the Establishment Clause says you can't have an official religion, and the prayer is always a Christian prayer. And so they said, you know, that's picking a religion. 49 members of the U.S. House of Representatives filed a brief in support of the town of Greece, saying these elected representatives regard legislative prayer as important for policymaking bodies both to solemnize official occasions and to seek God's blessing, wisdom, and guidance in making consequential decisions. Now, just imagine how people would be responding and what would be happening, what would be going on. If I had come on the air and I had said, okay, they've, in Iraq, the country that, the modern Iraq, a country that we helped create after we took down Saddam Hussein, they have passed a law that says all official meetings must be opened with a prayer asking for the guidance of Allah or Allah. Ask for his blessing, his wisdom, and his guidance in making consequential decisions. And for this, you know, almost 5,000 of our soldiers and contractors, actually more than 5,000, include the contractors, died in Iraq. And hundreds of thousands of Iraqis died, and over 5 million were displaced, and the country was ruined, and people are being murdered on a daily basis there, all so that they could ask for Allah's guidance at before every government meeting, which is something that they didn't do, by the way, when Saddam Hussein ran the country, because he ran a secular government, not a religious government. And people would go, well, you know, we're not surprised, but it's pretty awful. Now, can you imagine if these 49 Republican members of the U.S. House of Representatives who filed a brief, a friend of the court brief, an amicus brief, with the U.S. Second Circuit Court of Appeals, saying that there should be prayer before public events to seek God's blessing. If instead it had said to seek Allah's blessing, or to seek Kali's blessing, or Hanuman, or Buddha, or the flying spaghetti monster. We need to seek the blessing of the spirits of the trees. Let's bring the animists into this. Can you imagine? It's like we're so close to it, we don't see it. People, Americans, they sit around going, oh, look at these Muslim terrorists. There are no Christian terrorists. But over in the Muslim countries, there's this country that's got this General Boykin running around saying, our God is bigger than their God, that is dropping bombs on them and killing innocent civilians, terrorizing them. In the name of Jesus? No Christian terrorists? Amazing.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
You can't have it both ways. Either we're a secular nation and we're killing these people to get their oil, or we're a Christian nation and it is the religious war. Welcome back. The Department of Education. This is interesting. You know, Obama took... This is something I salute. I applaud. He said, why is it that the federal government backstops student loans for the banksters in two ways? One, you know, they loan the money to the banks, and then the banks loan the money out. And when the loans get defaulted on, they guarantee them, basically. And two, the federal bankruptcy bill that was passed back during the Bush administration, for the first time in the history of the country, I mean, it used to be that basically you could declare bankruptcy on everything except your taxes. And in a couple of states, most notably Texas and Florida, you can declare bankruptcy and not include your house. But, and or keep your house. But the new federal bankruptcy law says that student loans can't be discharged through bankruptcy. So you can screw the bank, you can screw the credit card companies, you can screw your next door neighbor that you borrowed $5,000 from, the guy that sold you the car, everybody else. You can walk away from those debts. I shouldn't say you can screw them. I realize in most cases bankruptcy is the consequence of people finding themselves in absolutely horrific situations, and the courts make sure that those are principally the only cases that get through. But there is no way that you can discharge your obligation to pay your taxes or your student loans. And the banks were getting all the money from this. The banks obviously bought the legislators who passed the bankruptcy law back during the Bush administration. So, and we railed about this on this program back 5-6 years ago. I mean, it was just, this was... And you know, Joe Biden played a role in it. I called him out on it. We had that bankruptcy reform, and this was a piece of it. So what Obama did that I thought was a really good idea is he said, you know, why is it? I mean, these are no-risk loans, basically. And they're like, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7% interest. When you can borrow money from the Fed at less than 1% and then loan that out at no risk
for 6 or 7%. Talk about good work if you can get it. I mean, you can do that with $1 trillion. You can make billions every year in revenue. So Obama said, we're going to take the banks out of the equation. We'll just, you know, the federal government, if we're backstopping the banks to begin with, we'll just loan directly, these Stafford loans, we'll just lend directly to the kids. Now, they shouldn't have to do that. Keep in mind, when Reagan came into office, about 80% of all tuition was covered by federal, state, or schools funds, and only about 20% was covered, about one-fifth was paid for by students in the form of tuition. So tuition was low. It was cheap. You could go to college by working part-time at a minimum wage job. I did, my wife did, in the 60s and 70s. You could go to college that way and end up with no debt at all, unless you wanted to go to an Ivy League school and, you know, or medical school or something like that, neither of which I did. On the other hand, now post-Reagan, now is here we are, you know, 33 years into the era of Reaganomics. Reagan started this process by putting the guy who campaigned for president in the 1970s on a platform of ending the Department of Education, a fellow by the name of Bill Bennett, a washed-up right-wing talk show host, put him in charge of the Department of Education, the guy who said he was going to destroy the Department of Education. And ever since then, you've seen all this stuff collapse. And now, roughly, the numbers are upside down. About 80% of the money that goes for tuition comes out of the pockets of students, and about 20% comes out of the institutions themselves, not of federal and state and local taxes, you know, and monies. And so the cost of school has exploded. Plus, it used to be that not-for-profit schools, most states had laws that made it really hard to start for-profit schools, or at least to get them accredited. And so if you went to a for-profit school, it was typically referred to as a diploma mill. And nobody took the degree seriously, even if you had to work pretty hard for it. But, you know, Reagan changed all that, and now you've got all these for-profit schools in the mix, too. So, anyway, where am I going with this? Well, this is amazing. Figures made public last Tuesday by the Congressional Budget Office show the Department of Education, their profit forecast for this year went up 43% to $50.6 billion. The DOE, the Department of Energy, that's loaning this money out is going to make $50 billion in profit off student loans. ExxonMobil only made $44 billion last year. Now, the good news about this is that this is money that would have been made by Chase, whatever it is, and J.P. Morgan and Bank of America and Wells Fargo. This would have been made by the big banksters. And instead, it's being made by our government. So presumably, that profit can be rolled over into more student loans that can be available to kids. In the last five fiscal years, the Department of Education has generated over $120 billion in profit. What I don't know, and perhaps one of you knows, is the Department of Education taking this profit and using it for more student loans, or are they simply putting it back in the Treasury to reduce the national debt? I don't know the answer to that, and it is not in this news story, which makes me think that it's probably going into the Treasury, which would be a shame. But it's, you know, it would make perfect sense if the Republicans wrote the law that's making it all happen. Joan in Elk Creek, Virginia. Hey, Joan, what's up? You want to talk about prayer before events and government functions?
Yes. Hi, Tom. Thank you. I just think they should not do that. It's not appropriate because most of the time it's a Christian prayer, especially here in Virginia where I live. And if anything, they should just have a moment of silence or say something like, let's remember to respect others and recite the golden rule or something. That's universal.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of insulting to people from other religions when the prayer is always a Christian prayer. And I think a very easy answer would just be a moment of silence, and then people can think their own thoughts.
Yeah. I'm with you, and I'm totally with you. Or they should pass a law that says if prayer is called for in our public events, the names of Allah, Buddha, Shiva, You know, I mean, just, you know, come up with a list of gods and goddesses that have to be included in the prayer. And, you know, that'll rattle their cage. Joan, thanks a lot for the call. Betty in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on 1350 AM. Hey, Betty, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. So, such a pleasure to talk with you. Sir, I don't know if I'm behind the times, but I just read this morning, and I was appalled by this bit of information, that the administration of the GED has been placed in private hands, and that will be in effect in January of next year.
Really?
The cost of getting a GED is now going to be not only be raised exponentially, but no one will be allowed to take it with pen and pencil any longer. They will have to do it via computer.
Probably from home or something, or in.
I don't know.
But
all I know is the cost. According to, believe it or not, I read about this in Dear Abby. A gentleman who's affiliated with the new legislation wanted her to get it out to as many of her readers as possible, that anybody who's interested in getting a GED should do it now and do it as soon as possible before this new legislation takes effect in January.
That's amazing. When I was in high school, I published this underground newspaper called The Jurist. And the first issue called on teachers to let us smoke in class and to decriminalize, smoke cigarettes and to decriminalize pot. And the second issue was, went off on the Vietnam War and got me bounced out of high school. And so I took a GED. And at that time, it was, and scored in the 98th percentile overall across the five categories, which was kind of cool. But my recollection is that I didn't have to pay anything. I think it was just, you know, the city did it or the state or something. It's
well,
amazing.
According to the information the man gave to the Abbey column, not long ago it was about $7.50, and over the years it's escalated to $25, $35. Now I think it's around the $40 range. He said now that it's in the hands of this private firm, it is just going to go through the roof.
Yeah,
it's going to cost the earth for somebody to do this.
It's going to end up being hundreds or maybe thousands.
Occasionally you find an old person that would want to do this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, somebody who didn't graduate from high school who wants to show that they've graduated from high school. Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, thank you for the call, Betty. I was fine with it, actually, because back when I was in the second grade, that was when Sputnik went up, and Eisenhower and the whole country freaked out. And Eisenhower said, "Okay, we're gonna generate a generation of scientists and engineers." And they poured all this money into the elementary schools in America to identify gifted kids and run them, fast track them. And I was one of those kids, and I got fast tracked, you know, from second grade through sixth grade. By the time I was finished with sixth grade, I had basically, you know, I was doing high school math and reading at the college level and geometry and early calculus and certainly had algebra down. And so high school for me was a big letdown. It was boring as hell. I already knew that stuff. Anyway, we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Because by the time I got to high school, they had ended all those programs because, hey, you got to pay for the Vietnam War, you know. It's amazing how things change. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 10 minutes before the hour. And the place where despair is not an option. And Marty in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Marty.
Hey, Tom. What a pleasure.
Thanks
love
for
your
calling.
Show. Today, I was just sharing with your speaker that the only reason I was able to pay my two of my son's tuition and continue to pay the third is that my parents set up a business and gave it to their children, and with the stipulation that we would first use the money to pay for their grandchildren's college tuition.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been able to afford
pay it forward.
But when you're yes, and but you, something you brought back a memory. I remember in grade school, I'm a few years younger than you, going through a huge battery of tests. To all the kids had to go through this huge battery of tests to gauge where we were. And I think it was third or fourth grade, I was testing at a senior in college reading level because
mm-hmm.
I just loved reading, incessantly was reading, and was accused of cheating. Made to take the test over again, and well, you can imagine I scored even higher. But that was right at the same point that, but nothing happened of it. You know, I think it was part of that at screening for gifted children.
Yeah, there was a time, and maybe they didn't follow through in your town, and they didn't in ours after elementary school, which for me was a disaster. But we got myself and another kid in our school, and there were a bunch of other kids in other nearby schools got pulled out. And this was my recollection is that I was second grade, and maybe it was the next year, but it was when Sputnik went up. What was that, 56, 57, something like that, 58, whatever the year was, the Sputnik went up. It was the year after. And we were so fast-tracked that they were concerned that what if these kids are being made crazy by this, right? Because we were learning. I had 2 years of Spanish. By the time I graduated sixth grade, I had Latin. I had... And in any case, me and my friend Terry, and Terry's dad was a psychologist, and he had all these books, and we used to read them, you know, and he had one on the Rorschach test. And one of the things that they did four times a year, Shane is smiling. Have I told this story before? No, a long time ago. Okay. So we knew what the Rorschach test was, and that was one of the tests that they were giving, that this sweet young, you know, fresh out of college, 23-year-old young woman was the psychologist or the whatever it was, you know, the tester. And she came in and she would administer the test. And so Terry and I decided that we were going to play one on her. And one of us picked violence, the other picked sex. And I frankly don't remember which. I think mine was violence and his was sex. But it was like when she'd show the ink blots, we'd go, oh, my God, look at through that keyhole. What are those people doing? Or, oh, my God, they shouldn't, you know, you shouldn't show pictures like this to children. And, you know, just it totally freaked her out. And she ended up having the school and the principal and the vice principal and my teacher and Terry's parents and my parents. And we all had this meeting because they thought that we were like damaged goods. We'd been damaged by this super accelerated education program for bright kids. Because we'd been singled out, you know, in this program. And we had to convince them. And finally, Terry's dad spoke up and said, yeah, I do have that book on the Rorschach test. And, yes, my son has read it. And she's still, the psychiatrist was still, you know, bamboozled by seven-year-olds? No, I don't think so. Yeah, it happened.
Tom Hartman.
He is the only man to ever ace a Rorschach test.
That's right. Shane, I'll put that together. So... anyhow, Frank, thanks for calling and sharing your story. It's like, you know, ask yourself a question. If a company said, we're going to take the division of our company that has the highest percentage, the highest probability of profitability, the highest performance, and we're going to cut its funding, what would you think? I mean, that's what we did when the Vietnam War started in the mid-60s. Was they blew up all those accelerated education programs that I was part of when I was in elementary school. And, I mean, the summer that I was 14 years old, I got a scholarship to go to Michigan State University for the summer, did two papers. I was studying biology and biochemistry, and did one paper. It was called The Effects of the Mutagen Colchicine Upon Aspergillus Niger and Rhizopus Niger Canis. I still remember this. And colchicine is a drug that, you know, causes mutations, and we were looking at aspergillus and these are bread molds, and the other one was we tried to use DNase to kill the DNA in the nuclear to disassemble the DNA in the nucleolus of a large green it's got a macroscopic, you can see the nucleus, single-celled water plant. I'm forgetting the name of the water plant now. And our idea was nuke the DNA and then pull it out of another plant and put it in, you know, Frankenstein. And now they do this routinely. We tried to do this at MSU in, let's see, it must have been the summer of 1965. And we're unsuccessful. Although we did successfully mutate bread molds with colchicine. So, but, you know, in any case, then in our infinite wisdom, we said, we're not going to fund that anymore. We've got to fund this war in Vietnam. And now it's like we're not even going to fund kids who want to go to college. You know, whether they're at the bottom of the class, the middle of the class, top of the class, doesn't matter. We're not going to defend it. We're not going to fund any of them. Instead, we're going to throw them $1 trillion in debt. And as the resident old fart, let me tell you, looking back, this is crazy. This is absolutely crazy. Chris in Worcester, Mass. We have just 1 minute until the top of the hour. You got a quick question about a Bible quote?
Yeah.
Go for it.
Yes, hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
How you doing today, Tom?
Good. You had a question?
Yeah, I had a question. A couple of weeks ago, you were talking about the Bible, and I think it was in the book of Matthew, where you were talking about your favorite quotes.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
It's Matthew 25, and it's about halfway through the that chapter, and it's the part where Jesus is, you know, the disciples come to him and say, "How do we get into heaven?" And he said, at the end days, I'm going to be sitting there saying, okay, you guys who fed me when I was hungry, who gave me water when I was thirsty, who healed me when I was sick, you get to go with me to heaven. Visited me when I was in prison, clothed me when I was naked. And they freaked out and they said, we never saw you hungry or thirsty. We're screwed. And he said, no, as you do to the least among, you know, the least of these, your brethren, you have done unto me. That's in Matthew 25, Chris. And I think it's probably the most important part of the entire New Testament. Thank you very much for your call. We will be back. Judson Phillips, attorney and founder of the Tea Party Nation, is going to be with us. This should be entertaining.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. And lots of sturm and drang in the House Oversight Committee. Daryl Issa, the chairman. Oh, boy, we have the IRS asking Tea Party groups to prove that they're actually engaged in social welfare, which the IRS code, the actual law, Section 501c3 and Section 501c4, require that you exclusively engage in social welfare. The IRS rules by which they administer those laws say that you must principally engage in social welfare. And apparently, back in 2010, If you were applying for 501c3 or 501c4 status for a few months, if your name had Tea Party or Patriot in it, because there were so many of these groups just like coming out of the woodwork, this group of low-level employees at the IRS office in Cincinnati or Cleveland in Ohio said, okay, set those, you know, take a look at those, give them a little extra scrutiny, because that doesn't sound like social welfare to me. So let's find out. Is the Tea Party a social welfare group? Judson Phillips is an attorney and the founder of the Tea Party Nation, the website teapartynation.com. Judson, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom. Good to be back with you.
Thank you. I think everybody knows about liberal groups that are all about social welfare, liberal groups that are doing things like running soup kitchens or that are running educational programs or you know, programs for abused kids. Or liberal groups that are incorporated specifically to lobby for things like, you know, more widespread educational access. These things all seem to me fairly clearly to be social welfare. In fact, I would argue that social welfare and liberal are kind of interchangeable terms. Why would a Tea Party group that is arguing to keep taxes low on billionaires and people like Paris Hilton and Mitt Romney, and that wants to prevent us from doing anything about the gun problem in this country, and maybe you can identify some other things that the Tea Party groups are standing for overtly. I mean, those are the two things that come to mind. What do either of those things have to do with the social welfare of the United States?
Well, for starters, quote, social welfare doesn't just apply to, quote, liberals. I know many conservative groups that work soup kitchens, do other things like that, do programs to feed the poor.
But the Tea Party?
People are sick. Not Tea Party groups, no, but Tea Party.
Okay, so what does the Tea Party do that is, what does the Tea Party do that is social welfare that should make it qualify for 501c3 or C4 status?
The Tea Party does basically what's the same thing that a lot of groups on the left do. They advocate for public policies that are good for the United States of America.
In their opinion.
And, yeah, well, in their opinion, well, the left opines that theirs are good for America, too, so it's a two-way street.
Right. So can you identify some of those policies, Judson, What policy actually enhances the social welfare of you know, a poor person from Tennessee, you know, watching us right now or listening on the program, and the only job they can find is as a greeter at Walmart. They're struggling to get by. The Republicans in Congress, this new farm bill, the Republicans in the House of Representatives want to cut $21 billion in food stamps out, so they won't be able to feed their kids. They want to do away with food programs for the schools. They want to dial back on a long-term unemployment if a fellow's wife or her or the husband just, you know, has been unemployed for a while. How does any of this help that person? Let's say that that person is the social whose welfare is being defined. What would you do? How is a Tea Party helping that person?
What the Tea Party is doing is by advocating programs that work, like less government, lower taxes. We want everybody to have jobs.
So,
to be on welfare. I want them to all be employed.
Okay. Let's just get this very clear. Let's be very explicit about it. So you're saying that less government, lower tax. So if David Koch and Charles Koch and Mitt Romney and Paris Hilton pay less taxes, that's somehow going to help that unemployed family in Tennessee who's trying to make it on food stamps and unemployment.
So if a mom and pop business can have their taxes cut and have the regulations.
Mom and pop businesses don't pay taxes, Judson.
Yeah, they do.
No, they don't. Do you run a small business? Have you ever run a small business?
Yes.
End of every year say, okay, you know, we needed to buy a printer all year long. We've got a $3,000 profit left over that we're going to have to pay taxes on. So let's just buy the damn printer at the end of the year. Don't you do that?
The IRS rules allow you a certain number of years where you can declare losses, but there are a certain number of years you have to make a profit, or if you do not, the IRS comes down on you.
Yeah, they say you're a hobby, not a business, but you can show a profit of $100, and you're not going to pay any taxes on that for all kind, you know, of any consequence.
If you cut taxes for Google, for example, I'm going to pick a big company. If Google can have their taxes cut by, pick a random number here, $10 million. How much of that money can go to hire new employees?
None of it.
That's it.
Google only hires employees when they need them, and they hire them regardless of what their taxes are. Raising or lowering their taxes will do is raise or lower the dividend that they pay to their stockholders, and well over 80% of all the stock in the United States is held by the top 1%. You're not helping that guy in Tennessee who's on unemployment and food stamps and his kids are getting their meals at the local school. He's not a stockholder in Google.
Sure you are. When you cut taxes, it works every time. When you cut taxes, the economy grows.
We 33 years of Reaganomics here, Judson. Reagan. We've been cutting taxes for 33 years. The economy sucks.
Reagan cut taxes, a massive tax cut.
Yes.
And look what happened. We went from the Depression of the Carter era the boom of the 80s.
Actually, the 70s was the last decade that we had over 3% GDP growth for an entire decade. It was the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. The only three decades in the history of the United States when we had over 3% GDP growth. It dropped below 3% during the decade that Reagan was president, and Reagan tripled our national debt. So to the extent that we didn't have a depression during Reagan, although we did have the biggest, as you will probably recall, the biggest stock market crash and the biggest spike in unemployment. Unemployment went up to 12% under Ronald Reagan. And we had the biggest stock market crash since 1929. And he wallpapered that over by borrowing $2 trillion and spending it. Back at that time, I was running around saying, you give me a $2 trillion credit card, I'll show you what it looks like to live large. That's not fixing an economy. That's borrowing and spending. That's the stuff that you guys are supposed to be opposed to.
When Reagan cut taxes, when Reagan came into office, unemployment was at 12%.
No, it wasn't.
That's about a year for anything. I lived through that era.
So did I.
I dropped out of college, and I was working in radio at the time. An experience you can relate to, getting paid all the T-shirts you can eat.
Yeah.
And I was trying to make ends meet watching gas prices under Carter go up literally every day, going to the grocery store.
Well, after the Arab oil embargo, of course.
It wasn't just the Arab oil embargo. It was the poor management, the pitiful management of the Carter era. When we got in under Reagan.
So you want to turn this into a fight about Reagan and Carter. I have not heard, Judson, anything about how a Tea Party group is a social welfare group. I'm not hearing it.
Tea Party groups are as much social welfare groups as some of the groups on the left. Let's say
if there's a group on the left,
Media Matters.
Okay.
Media Matters is set up as a 501c4. Just
right.
like some of the Tea Party groups.
Right.
What does Media Matters do? Media Matters goes around like smearing people and acts as the media office.
Media Matters mostly goes around outing lies told on Fox News and on right-wing media. And you know, I would agree with you that that's probably not a social welfare group. I think that the IRS needs to tighten up these guidelines.
So I've got a better idea. Let's abolish Section 501 of revenue code altogether. I have a huge problem.
Do away with all the nonprofits.
Do away with all of them.
Okay.
At least the people.
Other
I
than
know.
You know, what are you going to do about schools or communities for abused kids, stuff like that? You don't want to do those on a for-profit basis, do you?
No, but you know what? You don't need the nonprofit status to be able to raise funds or do any number of things.
Okay, Judson Phillips, TeaPartyNation.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Thanks for dropping by, Judson. We'll have to delve into this deeper next time. Thanks for dropping by.
Hey, thank you, Tom. We'll see you later.
Talk to you soon. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week here on the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. And Danny in Waco, Texas, listening on Sirius. Hey, Danny, what's up?
Yeah, you know, I was listening to this guy, you know, before talking about no taxes, no taxes, no taxes. And I get tired of hearing them say that because there are more people in the United States. You're going to have more basic government to cover the fact that you have more people. Okay, then they say, well, cut the taxes. Well, if they cut one tax, your tax for your house is going to go up.
Yeah.
Your other local taxes are going to go up. They're going to do school bonds because they need money to, like, repair the schools. Okay, and then the roads look like crap. So you yourself, you have this $90,000 car that you, when you drive down the road, you got potholes that's tearing the darn thing up, you know. And I always tell people, you know, you can make your money and you think you don't have to help anybody else. But at that moment when you're driving in your nice new car and that kid who can't go to school because he can't afford it and he feels like he has no way out is standing at your window with a 9mm because he's going to carjack your nice new car, who you think is going to win that argument? Because, yeah, you might be carrying a gun, but the thing of it is he's got his cocked and loaded at your window.
Yeah. Yeah, I think your point is an excellent point. And basically, this is the consequence of Reaganomics. Reagan dropped the top tax rate on rich people from 74% down to 28%. And what happened was that communities all across the country said, we can't make it on this. And so we're going to stop fixing our roads. We're going to stop improving our schools. We're going to cut back on the pay for our teachers. We're going to stop the resources for our schools. Teachers are going to have to start bringing in their own books and their own paper and in their own chalk. There are schools around the country where teachers are buying chalk. And our infrastructure, we're going to stop fixing our infrastructure. We're going to stop fixing our bridges and our roads. We're going to stop fixing our water and septic systems. And this country has been falling apart since the Reagan presidency, and it's all because of this religion of taxes. You are absolutely right, Danny. Thank you very much. And we need to be investing in the most important infrastructure of all, our intellectual infrastructure, our young people. Richard in Monclova, Ohio, watching on Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. What's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am well, thank you.
Very good. Two brief comments, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
First, I believe the real scandal at the IRS is indeed the fact that the Heritage Foundation, Crossroads America, Media Matters, and all these other political organizations have a tax-exempt status.
Yeah, and Media Matters is on the left. My point where I was agreeing with Judson is I think if you're going to be tax-exempt, you should be actually providing services. And those groups that are providing information or lobbying or whatever, I don't think that they should have a tax exemption. I don't want to pay for their fire service. I don't want to pay for their police service, even if they're on my side. I think that, you know, they and as I said, you know, small organizations that are run on a for-profit basis typically don't pay taxes. You know, at the end of every year, what a small company does is they look around and they say, okay, you know, we've got X number of dollars left over in the till. What are we going to do? We're going to buy some equipment, or we're going to, you know, I mean, typically that's what companies do is they buy equipment, or give bonuses to employees or whatever. But, you know, they vary. So, you know, you can run these organizations on a for-profit basis and not pay income taxes.
Very
by and large.
Second comment. Matthew 25:31 is even a little more scary, I think, than you pointed out,
yeah,
in that it says that Jesus is going to call the nations together.
Yes.
And separate them as a shepherd separates the sheep and the goats.
Yes.
And the good are the ones who are going to organize themselves in such a way that their poor are taken care of. And the goats, the bad, are the ones that organize themselves in such a way that they don't do that.
Yeah, I have a friend who is a devout Christian, who is a conservative, who debates me on television a lot. And I had this conversation in an email with her a while back where she was like, how can, you know, okay, Jesus said, you know, sheep and goats and all this stuff, that's fine for you and me. You know, I should be giving to charity. You should be giving to charity, whatever. But how can you turn that into liberal philosophy? And I said, read the beginning of Matthew 25:31. It says, before me shall stand the nations. And our, you know, so we will be judged as a nation. If you believe literally that the Bible is true, and many of these conservatives and Republicans claim that they do, if you believe that, then... And particularly if you think that this is a Christian nation, which I don't believe it is, but if you believe that, then the scarier part than that, Richard, is he says it's the nations that are going to be judged en masse, number one, and number two, that the ones that don't go along with it are going straight to hell, you know, eternal damnation, and it's like, you know, something out of Dante's Inferno. Richard, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Jeremy in Charlotte, North Carolina, you disagree
hey,
with
Tom,
me.
How are you?
I am fine.
My point in calling in this time wasn't necessarily a disagreement with you, but right now it sounds like we're debating the finer points of who should be tax exempt, who should not, and what has happened or what's been uncovered over the past 2 weeks. I mean, I think it's obvious to say if the shoe were on the other foot and this was George Bush targeting left groups,
he did.
I don't think it would be.
He did. There was a church in Pasadena where the pastor gave a sermon saying just before the election, saying that a preemptive war policy is not Christian. And the IRS came down on him like a ton of bricks.
There was nothing systematically done by the Bush administration.
That was actually in response to outrage from the right. There were several nonprofit organizations during that Bush era. But I'm guessing you would condemn that, too.
Absolutely, I would condemn that.
Okay.
But you know what? That didn't even rise. I listened to both sides, and, you know, for some reason, that obscure thing that you've just brought up to justify that never really.
It's not obscure over on the left wing websites. It's all over them.
Well,
and it's not just one,
okay.
It's one of many.
So is it defensible? What's happening now?
Are
you?
No, of course not. Of course not.
Is it not a complete
absolutely not.
Crisis?
But the fact of the matter is that there was this explosion of Tea Party groups that wanted tax exempt status. There was not a similar explosion of Occupy groups wanting tax exempt status. There wasn't. There was no Koch brothers for the Occupy groups. There was no billionaire funding them. There was no, you know, money behind them. And, you know, you got a couple of employees at the IRS down there in Cleveland or Cincinnati or wherever the city is, and they can't get more resources from Congress. The Republicans won't hire a couple of extra people. What are you going to do?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And so they were looking for ways to figure out, okay, who's really a school or feeding hungry people, and who's just doing politics? Having Tea Party in your name? Yeah, okay. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, do we really need... Actually, I think we do. Need to really reconsider this whole nonprofit thing. Because, you know, nonprofit status means not just that you don't pay taxes on income that you make. Because, as I pointed out, 97% of all corporations in America don't pay income taxes. And the reason why is you've got, first of all, about a quarter of all the major, large, profitable corporations, they don't pay federal income taxes because they scam the system. They run their money through offshore entities and banks in the Cayman Islands, and, you know, they do the stuff that Mitt Romney does. But small companies in the United States... Any small business in this country pretty much knows that, you know, hey, at the end of the year, you got a couple $1,000s left over. If you don't want to pay taxes, well, first of all, if you've only got $2,000 or $3,000 left over, you might as well carry that into the next year because your tax bill is going to be $50. You know, even the corporate income tax is progressive. But, you know, if you've got a little more than that left over, hey, it's time to buy that printer you've been planning on buying all year or whatever it may be. And that's, you know, that's just, you know, especially if it's important stuff, if it's the stuff that you need. This is how, you know, so businesses don't pay profit, and, or they don't pay tax, rather, by and large. But the key is not avoiding federal income tax. The amazing thing is that genuinely tax-exempt social welfare organizations don't have to pay property taxes. They don't have to pay state and local taxes. The property tax is the big one. Right? There are communities that have, you know, large campuses where they've got nonprofit schools, large campuses that generate no revenue. They have, it'd be really interesting to get a map of Washington, D.C. and see how much of this city is owned by not-for-profit corporations that are not paying property taxes. Now, sometimes you choose, a nonprofit organization can choose to pay their property taxes. When I was running the New England Salem Children's Village up in New Hampshire back in the late 70s and early 80s, we actually chose to pay our property taxes to the city of Rumney. And it was like a $7,000 or $8,000 a year tax bill, as I recall. And in fact, we may still be paying our property taxes. I'm not sure, but it's entirely voluntary for a not-for-profit. And we did it because the city, we're at the end of a 3.5-mile long dirt road on the backside of, you know, we're on a mountain on the backside of a lake, and the town plows the road. And the town provides the school bus to take our kids to school, and the town provides a lot of services that we use. And so we felt that not to pay, and this is a town of like 800 people, not to pay our property taxes would place an unfair burden on those people in town, and we would end up being so hated by the town that, you know, you wouldn't want to be there. And the people in town really appreciated the fact that we paid our taxes, because there was a Christian day camp in Rumney, New Hampshire, that owned a substantial chunk of property, and they did not pay their taxes. And so, anyhow, the point is that tax-exempt status confers some incredible advantages. Plus, you can take, you know, when you take a contribution from somebody, they can write that off on their taxes. So less federal taxes are paid, not just by the not-for-profit corporation itself, but by the people donating to it. And that's why I'm of the opinion that only those organizations that are actually providing for public welfare, not talking about public welfare, not, you know, I don't think that I should be able to make this show into a not-for-profit organization, although virtually all of the Christian radio shows are. And there's an entire right-wing broadcasting company I know that is run as a nonprofit corporation, a right-wing network. And they have right-wing talk show hosts who don't talk about religion. They talk about politics. But it's a, you know, this company also publishes Bibles. And so it's like these, it should be that if you are in the business of feeding people, of housing people, I mean, Habitat for Humanity, they should be a not-for-profit organization. Meals on Wheels should be not-for-profit. The Hunter School, Salem Children's Village, not-for-profit. I understand that. I think everybody in America understands that. But groups that are trying to influence public policy, that are trying to change the political debate in this country, on the left or the right, I do not think should be not-for-profit. I don't think political parties should be not-for-profit. I don't think churches should be not-for-profit, with the single exception of monasteries. Let's make this real. Let's get real about the tax code here in the United States. Because the rest of us are carrying the load on the commons for the cost of the commons. Kay in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Kay, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I was listening to the last guy. The one thing I want to say is at least the conversations I heard where they disagreed with you, It was really civil. And the boy, isn't that nice.
Yeah.
But I'll give you one example from the Bush administration. I can't really say that it came from the Bush administration and it wasn't the IRS. But how about the Congress going after ACORN? Now, I'm a social worker. I went to school to be a social worker, and I actually applied for a job and was interviewed, and they wanted to hire me for a job for ACORN in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason I didn't take it is because it was I physically couldn't do all the walking because you were out in the communities.
Yeah.
Every single day talking with them, finding out what their issues were in their communities, and helping them bring their voice, you know, out.
Acorn
and
was doing good work on behalf of poor people, particularly minorities, and that's why the Republicans in Congress destroyed them.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, you know, and they would assume they had nonprofit, but
yeah,
you know,
they were.
But
they were nonprofit.
Blue Cross and Blue Shield still, are they still nonprofit?
Depends on the state. I know in Michigan that they are. I don't know if they are here.
I know when I was taking a, you know, yeah, U.S. government class, and my professor said that they were. That just blew my mind. I said, why?
Well, it used to be prior to Reagan that in pretty much every state in the union, if you wanted to run a health insurance company, it had to be not-for-profit. And if you wanted to run a hospital, it had to be not-for-profit. And that changed during the Reagan years, and that's why all these for-profit hospitals popped up. Bill Frist's daddy created HCA, I think it was called. He made an absolute screaming fortune, over $3 billion by buying up county hospitals, not-for-profit hospitals, local city and county hospitals, and flipping them for-profit, laying off half their staff, jacking the prices up, you know, reducing the service. And it's just incredible. But, Kay, thank you. Thank you for reminding us of Acorn. It's excellent. Mike in Yuba City, California. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Great. What's up?
I think I said Media Matters, but now that I was looking, I think it was from the, not West Coast, but I heard it on Mark Thompson. They said that in 2010 to 2012, there was three groups.
Yeah, Progress Texas, I think, was one of them. It's not hard to Google it and find it. I don't have them off the tip of my brain here, but I've read the articles.
But
yes.
They were all liberal, correct?
Yes, there were three progressive groups that did not get their tax-exempt status that were applying during this era when they were, you know, looking more closely at the Tea Party groups. The Tea Party groups were getting their tax-exempt status.
Yeah, the Paul Rose new group to make the status, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, so, I mean, to me, any argument past that's kind of nonsense.
I absolutely agree with you, Mike. If Karl Rove can get nonprofit status, then our standards for nonprofit status are way too lax. Cindy in Euclid, Ohio. Hey, Cindy.
Well, hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Good. What's up?
I had a few points to make about the education. I wonder if you recall the quote by Adolf Hitler that every educated person is a future enemy.
No, I don't, but it doesn't. But it makes sense. I mean, you know, he went on a jihad against college professors. It's a variation on why Pol Pot, the first people in Cambodia that he murdered when he began the great genocide, killed 2 million people, were people who wore glasses.
Only property of the elite, and it seems to be a trend that's continuing.
Yeah.
They're also taking another page. I just, this Ayn Rand thing, or Ayn Rand, or whatever the hell her name was.
Alicia Rosenberg was her actual name.
Yeah. Do you recall the twisting of an old 1864 document called the, I can't remember the name of it, it was in French, but it was about a conversation between Machiavelli and Montesquieu, and it was twisted by the Russians around the time of the revolution. Mm-hmm. To the protocols of the Wise Men of Zion.
Right, yeah. The Russian Secret Service created that, yeah.
The Jews, and then later used by the Nazis.
Yeah, or at least, yeah, nobody's really sure, but that's the best guess, I think. As I recall, I saw that at Yad Vashem, a piece about that. But, yeah,
I wanted to ask you, is there anything being done about the media?
By the way, it wasn't like the Russians. It was the Tsar. Yeah. Is there anything being done about the caucus room meeting?
Yes. I mean, none dare call it treason, apparently, but...
yeah, somebody needs to write a book about that titled None Dare Call It Treason. No, to the best of my knowledge, there isn't, and there should be. I'll riff about that a little bit when we come back. Cindy, thanks for the reminder. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. Who should the rest of us carry, as it were, by virtue of their nonprofit status? Who should it be? Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, on the line with us. Brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. What's going on, Victoria?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I've recently come from the White House briefing, and there were a couple of main topics, really, today, which sucked all the oxygen out of the room for everything else.
Oh, I see you're in the basement of the White House in the Talk Radio News luxury suite.
Yes, I've normally left by now. I've normally done the briefing and then left, but it was a very late briefing, so I'm still here.
Okay.
Of course, the main issue was the IRS targeting of conservative and Tea Party groups. And what we learned today was from Jay Carney was that the White House, at least this is the latest, is that the White House counsel, Catherine Rumler, learned about the Inspector General's audit on April the 24th. And then she informed Dennis McDonough, the chief of staff, and other senior aides about the probe's findings, although the report wasn't complete, and made the decision that the president should not be told. They made the decision the president should not be told, partly because the report was not finalized, the findings could change, but also partly because the targeting had ended, so he couldn't swoop in and do anything to stop it, but also because if, put it this way, the briefing that spent an hour today asking why wasn't he told would have been a briefing about did he interfere with the investigation.
Right.
He had been told.
Right, right, exactly. What did he know and when did he know it?
It
would have been the Richard Nixon question.
Exactly, and what did he do about it?
Right.
The other subject is this Justice Department investigation of possible leaks of classified information about North Korea in 2009, in which they got phone records of James Rosen, a Fox News investigative reporter, but also his private emails through a subpoena. And this has caused a lot of consternation among the press and among many other people that the private emails could be obtained and that he could be targeted in this way, and that there is real concern, because it is an open question whether it's ever illegal, given the First Amendment's protection of press freedom, for a reporter to solicit information, even if he did get hold of a classified report, which he may have done. No reporter, including Rosen, has ever been prosecuted for doing this. And so this is still a very early story, but it was something that Jay Carney refused to comment on.
Very, very interesting. I'm curious, as you know, there's a piece over at Esquire.com by Carl Roll, R-O-L-E, where he's talking about Jonathan Carl. He says, if Jonathan Carl doesn't like being called a hack, then he should stop being a hack. There's one way to do it. Blow the source who lied to you and therefore lied to us. Do that or be a hack. There's no third alternative. I'm curious, you know, Jonathan Carl, of course, who publicized the Republican or the White House emails that had been doctored by Republicans to make it look like the White House was trying to cover Hillary Clinton's backside when, in fact, no such thing ever happened. What's going on with that? I mean, you're part of the press corps.
Well, he did one thing, and then Major Garrett also got it wrong. And Major Garrett went live on CBS News last Thursday night, I believe it was, and said flat out that he was lied to by Republican sources who told him one thing about what was in the emails. And then when the emails came out the following Wednesday and he read the quotation of what the Republican sources told him, and then he read what the actual email said.
Yeah, well, Major Garrett has a lot of integrity. I have a lot of respect for him. I've never met Jonathan Carl. I have no idea. You know, I don't know him or anything
Carl
about him.
Carl has given a very, very qualified apology, but it's not an apology.
Why
it's
not just
really
come
more
out
of an excuse?
You know, is there any reason for him not to out his source?
No reason at all. I mean, because he can't trust that source in the future, so why not oust it?
Right. I mean, as a journalist, if a source lies to you, don't you want? I mean, you have no obligation to maintain confidentiality at that point, do you?
No, none. I mean, this whole question of access, at this point, access to whom? It's not access to somebody who's going to be useful to you, unless it's a senator.
Well, and that's the question here, and this is, you know, what's Joy Reid, this little gem that she dropped. She said, you know, basically, who is on the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs and also on the Intelligence Committee? And it turns out of the senators, you know, Coburn, McCain, Johnson, Portman, Paul, Enzi, Ayotte, on the Senate Homeland Security Committee. Only one of them is also on the Intelligence Committee, and that's Tom Coburn. And the day before Carl published his piece, Tom Coburn was on the Joe Scarborough show saying, you know, basically another shoe is going to drop tomorrow. You know, what did he know and when did he know it? And why is nobody asking that question?
It's a very valid question.
Has anybody brought this up in any of the press conferences?
Not that I'm aware of.
Amazing. Okay, back to you.
I don't know whether I heard you mentioning Supreme Court stuff. I don't know whether you've talked about the Supreme Court's decision today that it's going to hear a new case on the intersection of religion and government in a dispute over prayers used to open public meetings.
Yes, I'm guessing that if instead of praying to God, they had been specifically praying to Allah, that or Kali or Shiva, that this would not be something that the right-wingers would be pushing up to the Supreme Court.
That's a possibility. Although the people who are pushing it up, actually, are people who felt marginalized by the Christians.
Aha. Uh-huh. So, and the Christians are defending it. But there were 49 members of the U.S. House of Representatives who filed amicus briefs saying that we need to have these things. We need to ask God for his blessings and replace the word God with one of these other gods, you know, other religious icons. And suddenly I suspect they wouldn't be writing an amicus brief for the Supreme Court.
This is going to become a very, very big case.
Yeah, yeah. An establishment clause case.
Yeah.
Yeah. What else is up?
A very, very big case. Final story is that Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon,
good man,
is going to introduce an amendment to the farm bill this week that would stop farmers from using harmful genetically modified seeds from the major seed producer Monsanto.
Whoa. So it would stop them from doing it or stop them from having any government subsidies if they do it?
No, he's going to stop them from doing it because there was something put into the continuing resolution to protect Monsanto.
So this is doubling down on reversing out the Monsanto Protection Act.
Correct.
Good on Jeff Merkley. Amazing. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, as we speak, it is 5:07 Eastern Time on Monday, the 20th of May. And as we speak, the Oklahoma City is being torn apart. There's a giant tornado, two miles wide as it moved through the town of Moore, Oklahoma, which is just south of the Oklahoma City metropolitan area, kind of a suburb of Oklahoma City, according to CNN affiliate KFOR. They're warning residents to go underground if you are in Oklahoma. Get safe. Get underground. This is more than 171,000 people in the path of the storm. 500,000 square miles under the gun for severe weather. An estimated 300 homes have already been destroyed. Several confirmed dead. And this is going on as we speak. This is what happens when you have an atmosphere that has been warmed by just a little less than a degree Celsius or a little more than a degree Fahrenheit. This is what happens when you have an atmosphere that contains 5% more water vapor than it did for the other 160,000 years of the history of the human race. This is what happens when you have 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, something no human being has ever seen before. We did not have CO2 levels at this height. I mean, the last time they were at this height, it was like Homo Australopithecus or something. I mean, it was some completely different Homo. It was not us. They might not have even been standing up straight. I, you know, I'd have to go back and track that down. But it wasn't us. We have never seen 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, ever. And now we're seeing storms, superstorms. Storms, historic storms, storms that are just unbelievable. CNN reporting, areas of metropolitan Oklahoma City appear to be in shreds Monday afternoon after a massive tornado moved through the region. The helicopter pilot for CNN affiliate KFOR, houses are destroyed, completely leveled, just south of Oklahoma City. The National Weather Service issued a rare tornado emergency for the Oklahoma City metropolitan area. You know, usually tornadoes don't hit cities, and it's not like they have an intelligence. Oh, gee, let's avoid the city. It'll kill more people. We don't want to go there. No, it's not like that. It's that the city, it's the same reason you typically don't get tornadoes in mountains. It's that the city breaks up the wind patterns and the air patterns in such a way that makes it really hard for tornadoes to happen. Unless the tornadoes are so big and so powerful. 2 miles wide? When I was a kid growing up in Michigan, I've seen tornadoes off in the distance. I've never had one close enough to me that I could hear the freight train, but, you know, I've seen them off in the distance, usually just up in the sky. I don't have a direct recollection of ever seeing one hit the ground, but we would see them in the sky a lot. You know, they'd come down to maybe 500 feet or so. And they were always just, you know, hey, it's a couple hundred feet across. They could do a lot of damage. They take out a couple of houses. They take out a trailer park. But this is amazing. This is amazing. It was running all last night. It was killing people. It still is. It's gaining new power as the sun is heating up the earth. We have entered a new time, a new era. It's a new geologic era. The Homo Zoic, as in Homo sapiens, the human Zoic. It's a new geological time. And we and our children and our grandchildren are going to be living in a time that, as NASA scientist James Hansen said, you know, when we get above 350 parts per million, which human beings had never seen before. Well, they'd never seen 400. They had arguably seen 350. But once we get above 350, we are living in an environment to which the human species did not evolve and is not adapted. This is not the world to which humans evolved. And still, we have organizations funded by the Koch brothers and other right-wing think tanks, principally the Koch brothers and ExxonMobil, the oil barons, the people who make their money on fossil fuels, funding climate change deniers. And in my mind, increasingly, these people have the moral authority of Holocaust deniers. Because if we continue to 450 parts per million, 500 parts per million, we're talking about an extinction event. We're talking about destruction that people can't imagine. And we have the ability right now to stop this in its tracks. I mean, if you actually were to calculate and capture the externality costs associated with burning fossil fuels, if you were to say to the coal companies, you are going to have to actually pay for cleaning up that fly ash from burning coal. You're going to have to actually pay for the asthmas and cancers that are the consequence of burning coal. You're going to have to actually pay for the miners who die in the mines. You're going to have to actually pay for the air and water pollution. If we were to capture the externalities, same thing with oil, same thing with natural gas, you're going to have to actually pay for the cost of the damage from this tornado. You're going to have to actually pay for the cancers associated with the high fractions, the benzenes and toluenes that come out of gas pipes as a consequence of burning petroleum. You're going to have to actually pay for those things. You're going to have to pay for the military defending the oil shipping lines, you know, across the Atlantic and increasingly the Pacific, as we now are exporting refined gasoline around the world. You're going to have to pay for all those things that, right now the taxpayers are paying for. If we said that, like the Danes did in Denmark, they said, okay, it costs about 10 to 14 cents per gallon of gasoline to our National Health Service to pay for the health consequences of gasoline. So we're simply going to add 10 to 14 cents. I forget what the exact amount was. When we were doing our show from Denmark 2 years ago, we had on the legislator who actually proposed the legislation. We're going to add 10 to 14 cents to the cost of a gallon of gasoline, and that money is going to go right to the National Health Service and pay for the cost of health care for the cancers and asthmas caused by burning diesel fuel and gasoline. If we actually captured those externalities, those costs associated with burning fossil fuels, all of a sudden, solar and wind are cheaper than fossil fuels. The only argument that has held weight in the United States and Canada and in China and India, the only argument that has allowed these countries that are rapidly increasing, although we're slightly decreasing, but you know, we're increasing production massively of fossil fuels, has been it's cheaper. There will be an economic impact to dialing back on it and moving to more expensive solar, wind, biomass, geothermal, wave energy. And that argument has only been able to be made because we as the taxpayers, we're picking up the cost of all the externalities. If we said, no, ExxonMobil, you're going to pay the externalities. No, Koch brothers, you're going to pay the externalities. Not we the taxpayers anymore. Not we the citizens anymore. Then all of a sudden, it is cheaper to put solar panels on the roof of every house in America and say, okay, we don't need any kind of we don't need nukes, we don't need any kind of power plants. We can do this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We can say we are not going to be like Oklahoma City and get wiped out by a nuke. Or, excuse me, by a giant thunderstorm with the power of a nuclear bomb. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, 21 minutes past the hour. You know, it was on June 9th, 1954, during the 30th day of the so-called Army-McCarthy hearings, when Republican Senator Joseph McCarthy was investigating the U.S. Army for so-called communist activities. And Joseph Welch, the head lawyer for the U.S. Army at that time, had had enough of Joe McCarthy's baseless accusations, his endless witch hunts, and his hyperbolic and partisan rhetoric, and called him out in front of Congress and in front of the American people.
May I say that Mr. Welch talks about this being cruel and reckless. He was just baiting. He has been baiting.
Senator, may we not drop this? Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator. You've done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?
But Welch wasn't the only one to offer insight to the American people about who Joe McCarthy really was and what he was really up to. The media, particularly Edward R. Murrow, used Welch's comment to out the senator's dirty and shameful tactics.
No one familiar with the history of his country can deny that congressional committees are useful. It is necessary to investigate before legislating. But the line between investigating and persecuting is a very fine one, and the junior senator from Wisconsin has stepped over it repeatedly.
At that time, Edward R. Murrow was one of the most respected and influential names in the entire world of journalism. His integrity, his willingness to call out McCarthy's grandstanding, have earned him a place of great honor in the history of journalism. Back in the 50s, our media were required by law and FCC regulations to perform the public service of giving us real news. And as a result, journalists could tell the truth and not just rehash the talking points handed out by the higher-ups in the morning meeting or handed down from the party bosses. The media was able to call out lawmakers like McCarthy, who had clearly overstepped his bounds and wasted countless tax dollars and man-hours on personal vendettas and never-ending conspiracy witch hunts. So, let's fast forward to today. Last Wednesday, Attorney General Eric Holder was testifying before the House Judiciary Committee about all the various so-called scandals that have plagued Washington in the last couple of weeks. On that committee, chairman of that committee, is Congressman Daryl Issa, Republican from California, who has made it his mission in life to blame everything wrong in Washington on the Obama administration and is now leading several McCarthy-esque hearings and witch hunts. And he's been exceptionally hard on Attorney General Holder and hasn't been shy about slamming the Attorney General at every chance possible. During Wednesday's hearing, all the friction between Holder and Issa came to a head when Eric Holder accurately described ISIS conduct while in Washington. This exchange came when ISIS was attacking President Obama's Labor Secretary nominee, Tom Perez, or Perez at his time, and his time at the Department of Justice. And Daryl Issa was harassing Attorney General Holder about emails that ISIS had requested in relation to Perez.
Will you make them available to the committee based on our bipartisan request?
I will certainly look at the request. It's not something that I have personally been involved in, but I'll look at the request and try to be as responsive as we can. I'm sure there must have been a good reason why only the to and from parts were prepared.
Yes, you didn't want us to see the details. Mr. Attorney General, knowing the to and from,
I'm not going to stop talking now. Characterize something as something
Mr. Chairman, would you inform the witness as to the rules of this committee?
It's inappropriate and it's too consistent with the way in which you conduct yourself as a member of Congress. It's unacceptable and it's shameful.
The Attorney General of the United States called a congressman's actions inappropriate, shameful, and unacceptable conduct for a member of Congress. You know, at any other time in the history of our country, that moment, that remarkable exchange would have ended Congressman Daryl Issa's career. But it won't. That's because the corporate-controlled media today has barely made a mention of it. Attorney General Holder's comments should have triggered a media firestorm over Congressman Issa and his time in Washington, but they haven't. They should have been the front page headline in the New York Times, but they weren't. They should have led the evening TV newscast. Instead, they were largely ignored. And this isn't the first time ISIS has gotten a free pass. This modern-day Joe McCarthy has continually flown under the radar of the mainstream corporate-controlled media. If there was any journalistic integrity left in the so-called mainstream media, Congressman ISIS would have been forced out of Washington long ago. May have never made it to Capitol Hill in the first place. John Perr. P-E-R-R, over at Daily Kos, has compiled Congressman Issa's Hall of Shame. It's an amazing read, over 20 items. There was the time in 2011 when Issa was leading the charge against the 9/11 responders' health care bill, which was eventually signed into law after it was unanimously passed through Congress. During his campaign to stop the bill, Issa said, "It's very simple. I can't vote for additional money for New York if I can't see why it would be appropriate to do this every single time a similar situation happens," which quite frankly includes any urban terrorist. It doesn't have to be somebody from Al-Qaeda. Bottom line, basically what he was saying was, sick and dying, 9/11 first responders, screw them. In fact, he said, it was simply an aircraft, residue of the aircraft, residue of the materials used to build the building. 9/11, nothing special, neither were the first responders, no big deal. Screw the cops, the firemen, the volunteers, let them die without a doctor. Back in 2007, Issa hit another career low. He attacked the families of the contractors who worked for Blackwater who had died in Iraq, while Blackwater was facing charges of abandoning these people, abandoning their families. Issa is defending the company instead of the workers. And then I'll play the clip for you when we come back. When Issa thought he had taken down Gray Davis in California, and then he discovered that Ken Lay had been having these secret meetings with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Gray Davis had spent $1 million of his own money to become governor of California. And he breaks down in tears. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Bottom line, we have a modern-day Joe McCarthy. The Attorney General calls him out, and it's not news? 28 minutes past that. The bad and the very, very semi Asulatelli ugly. The good. The District Department of Transportation, as part of its ongoing urban forestry initiative, the DDOT has planted over 7,000 trees around the District of Washington, D.C. this year alone. To celebrate the milestone, the department organized a tree planting celebration at Elliott Hine Middle School and has been posting pictures around the city to raise awareness about its urban greening initiative. Good work, DDOT. As I mentioned before, trees are an efficient and cost-effective way to cut down on the carbon footprint of major urban centers. But a new study reveals that a few trees that do exist in major urban areas are worth a ton of money. According to the U.S. Forest Service, trees in urban areas hold an estimated value of $50 billion as they provide valuable environmental services like storing carbon. Researchers found that urban trees store an estimated 708 million tons of carbon. In addition, researchers discovered that annual net carbon uptake by these trees is estimated at 21 million tons, which translates into $1.5 billion in economic benefits. Indeed. The bad. Glenn Grunhagen. During a session in the Minnesota State House of Representatives last week, the Republican legislator called global climate change a United Nations-created conspiracy. Seriously, listen.
But ultimately, the underlying philosophy that supports all this is the so-called man-made global warming or climate change theory. And, you know, the fact is, members, there's more and more evidence coming in that it's just a complete United Nations fraud and lie. Okay? The latest facts from CPAC show that in the last 16 years, there's been no global warming.
The latest facts from CPAC? I'm sorry. Facts from CPAC. Look up oxymoron in the dictionary, Glenn. Just last week, carbon concentration in the Earth's atmosphere passed 400 parts per million for the first time in human history. The only conspiracy here is the effort of Republicans like this guy to spread lies and misinformation about global warming to help out their big business allies. And the very, very ugly Pete Santilli. On a recent broadcast of his radio show, the conservative pundit went off on one of the most offensive, sexist, and outright violent rants in recent memory. Check this out.
How about Hillary Clinton? I want to shoot her right in the vagina, and just really, I don't want her to die right away. I want her to feel the pain, and I want to look her in the eyes, and I want to say, on behalf of all Americans that you've killed, on behalf of the Navy SEALs, the families of Navy SEAL Team 6 who were involved in the fake hunt down of this Obama bin Laden thing, that whole fake scenario. On behalf of all of those people, I'm supporting our troops by saying we need to try, convict, and shoot Hillary Clinton in the vagina.
Wow. There's not really much more you can say about Santilli's remarks than that they were, at the very least, very, very ugly. And now the Secret Service says that they're having a conversation with the young man. Yeah. Amazing. Okay, so I wrapped up the last segment by talking about how Daryl Issa, burned down his warehouse in order to get the insurance money to reboot his business, which is making car alarms in Asia, that has made him the second richest member of the House of Representatives, among other things. That he's basically a modern-day Joe McCarthy. And we played the clip of Eric Holder coming on, calling what he was doing shameful. And, the other part of the story, people don't remember. Daryl Issa spent over $1 million of his own money. Over $1 million of his own money to take down Gray Davis, when Gray Davis was the governor of California and Daryl Issa was an obscure congressman from California, because he wanted to run for governor. What he didn't know is that back even before the rolling blackouts that were done by Enron in California to take down Gray Davis, before those even began, Ken Lay was having secret meetings with Arnold Schwarzenegger about, I'm going to put you in the governor's office. Be my guy. And when Daryl Issa found out about that, the day that Arnold Schwarzenegger filed his papers, Daryl Issa literally broke down into tears. Here's the clip.
Campaign, but today the San Diego Republican was muscled out of his own dream to become governor.
And it's my desire, God Almighty. It's my...
Yeah, here he is just sobbing away, you know. Poor Daryl. He didn't get to be governor, but now he's a big guy in Washington, D.C. He's gonna get the president impeached. Come hell or high water, he's going to do it. Right. I just, you know, we talk about, you know, the damage that partisanship is inflicting on this country. I think that Daryl Issa is one of the best embodiments of that. It's really sad. And what's even sadder is that there's no Edward R. Murrow in the corporate press, in the mainstream media anymore, to call it out. That the mainstream media has gone so timid that when Jonathan Karl of ABC is given a literally fabricated White House email, fabricated by Republicans to make it look like Obama was trying to CYA for Hillary Clinton, when in fact she had done nothing wrong. The state, you know, there was no there. When Jonathan Karl is handed a lie-filled, reputed White House email, now we know that it's, you know, as Jake Tapper reported, it was full of lies. It's made up by Republicans to make the president look bad. Jonathan Karl runs with it, breaks it from the Foxosphere into the mainstream media world, and now refuses to out his source. He's not telling us which Republican handed it to him. It's crazy. It's like, you know, journalism, it's now infotainment, and an infotainment business. Oh, Jonathan Karl wants to protect his sources who lie to him? What did Tom Coburn know, and when did he know it? Because he's the guy who, the day before Jonathan Karl broke this story on ABC, so-called story, he's the guy who was on Morning Joe saying, guess what, there's something coming. I know all about it. Yes, indeed, I'm Dr. No, Dr. Coburn. Anthony in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Anthony, what's up?
Tom, I'm calling about the separation of church and state, but before I do, how long ago did Eric Holder call out Daryl Issa?
Oh, it was the middle of last week, Monday, Tuesday of last week. Yeah.
Good. It's about time he did something good. It's the only thing, good thing he's ever done.
Yeah, well, the sad thing is that nobody covered it. It's, you know, the old tree falling in a forest thing. Yeah.
Not even MSNBC?
MSNBC did cover it, yeah, I believe. I wasn't watching during that time, but I would be astounded if they did not. So I think that's a safe assumption. But MSNBC is not the mainstream media, you know.
State, you with me? The mayor of City Eureka is not only opening up government meetings with religious benedictions and invocations, he's also sponsoring public prayer meetings, utilizing city employees' time, money, and supplies to disseminate the information.
Well, you could stop him with a lawsuit.
We got it going, Carol Beaton and attorney Peter Martin. Secondly, the Humboldt County sheriff is on the television using the full weight and authority of his position, advertising his public prayer meeting on the radio and the television.
Hmm. Now, but his prayer meetings are, is he paying for these ads, or is he simply saying, put me on TV because I'm the sheriff and I want to talk about my, and are the prayer meetings private or public?
They're public, and I assume he's not. I assume they're being donated time. Otherwise, I would have heard about it by now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a problem with a public official coming out and saying, you know, I'm Muslim, I believe in Allah, and you know, or I'm Christian and I believe in Jesus, or I'm, you know, Buddhist, and I think that we all need to be meditating more, or whatever. You know, let's listen to the Dalai Lama. When they use public money to do it and public facilities to do it, then they've crossed the line. Anthony, thanks for the heads up on that. Jerry in Amityville, New York, got a minute to the break. Jerry, it's yours.
Yeah, on this whole situation involving the IRS and the Tea Party, you know, I think this controversy is going to continue as long as so many Democrats and so many people in the corporate media go along with the Republican narrative. And, of course, the Republican narrative is this whole idea that the Tea Party Republicans were targeted by the IRS, even though there was a Republican director in charge of the IRS during that period of time.
Right.
And I think some of the issues you're raising are more important, like the important question is, what does the Tea Party do to make it qualify for a 501c4c social welfare status?
Right.
And I think that that's the direction that we progressives need to go and ask these whole questions about who gets tax-exempt status and should they get tax-exempt status.
Yeah. I'm totally with you, Jerry. And when we come back, I'll play a clip of the turtle, Mitch McConnell, 20 years ago, complaining that liberal organizations had 501c4 status. It's amazing. It'll blow your mind. We'll be back. 46 minutes past there.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Yes, Mitch McConnell saying these liberal organizations are hiding under this, well, shirt in his own words. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, the headline, Trollbuster 9090 posted this over at democraticunderground.com. And Mitch McConnell in 1987, this would have been the next to the last year of the Reagan presidency, whining about the abuse of 501c4 status by left groups. Trollbuster must have been listening to our program, or else just understands, like, basic math, science, common sense, actually, is the phrase. The truth of the matter is, of course, that any group that actually promotes social welfare is by definition a left group. So when 501c4 groups are actually doing what 501c4 groups are supposed to do, Mitch was against it. Now that they're doing what they were never meant to do, which is engage in 100% partisan political campaigns, he likes them. The man of rubber strikes again. So here's Mitch McConnell. 87, 97, 2007, 13. This is like 25 years ago, right? 26 years ago? 7 is 3. Yeah, 26 years ago. Here he is, Mitch McConnell.
Existing law. You know, there are restrictions now on the kinds of activities that, for example, the 501c3 and 4 organizations, charitable organizations, can engage in that are being abused not just by people on the right, but most of the so-called charitable organizations who are involved in political activity in this country, who are, in my judgment, involved in arguable violations of their tax-free status and violations of the campaign laws, happen to be groups on the left. So that is a problem. The problem that you outline is a problem. It's a problem under existing law, and it would still be a problem under S2. It's not dealt with.
So, you know, they didn't fix this. you know, you should have fixed it, Mitch. Of course, the Supreme Court didn't help with Citizens United. I mean, they just made the situation even worse. Greg in Littleton, Colorado, listening on AM 760, Denver's progressive voice. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for getting me on. I've really enjoyed your show today. Great. I'm a first-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you. What's up?
I just have a number of things that...
Pick one.
I think, the attitude that is promoted towards Muslims and Islamic groups in this country is, to me, amounts to straight-out prejudice against people that I know that are beautiful, wonderful, kind-hearted people.
I agree. In fact, later on this week, Louise and I are having dinner with a friend of ours who's Muslim, and the vast majority of Muslims, just like the vast majority of Christians or Jews or Hindus or Buddhists or anything, are good and decent people. Greg, thank you for making that point. Well said. Dale in Roseburg, Oregon. Hey, Dale, thanks for watching Priest Peace TV. What's up?
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, great show. I've been with you for quite a while now.
What I have is the student loan that called that that was given. I have not called NDL. I've never heard it called that, but direct loan was what my student loans used to be under, subsidized and unsubsidized. And I believe that has to do with the interest rate, whether it's accrued during your time in school or not. And what that's been transferred to is Sallie Mae.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the Department of Education Loan Services. So right. I think I've gone back from apparently what must have been an independent type of loan contract to governmental. I'm also disabled, as was one of your other callers, and I've put in with Sallie Mae for assistance with the repayment of that because as it stands, you know, Social Security disability is boy, and there's a whole other subject.
It's not, yeah, it's not enough to pay a student loan on, yeah.
But, yeah, so this is a $10,000 loan, well, $11,000 at this point with interest that's, again, the unsubsidized loan, and it's eventually going to cost me about
$15,500. Wow.
So this is at a rate of $137, $140 a month.
That's insane. Dale, nobody in America should have to borrow money to go to college. This is insane. This is the richest nation in the world. I mean, if you were a Dane, if you lived in Denmark, not only could you go to college for free, but they would give you $100 a month as a stipend.
I've heard this, and I did meet a gal when I was going to, this is the University of Oregon, and it's a wonderful university, but met a gal from Norway, and I've considered Norway as a good alternative if, you know, worse comes to worse. But then again, we're going to hang in there.
They won't let us in. I looked into it. My grandfather's from Norway.
I'm going to hang in there, Tom. I'm going to hang in there, Tom. And as you said, tag, you're it.
Yeah, there you go. We've got it. We've got to make this country work. No, I'm Dale, I got to move along, but I'm completely with you. Thank you for the call. Kim in Santa Cruz, California. 1 minute to the end of the show. It's yours, Kim. What's up?
Hi, Tom. This is a little bit funny, but I was just wondering what it would take for the American people to incorporate. I mean, if we were incorporated, we would have Congress acting on our behalf.
If these people who have student loans had taken them out as corporations, they could repudiate them. As individuals, they can't. But corporations, you know, limited liability corporations, there's excellent, excellent point. Thank you, Kim, for the call. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia, got a quick point you can make in less than 20 seconds?
Yes, I just hope that they would utilize the scientific method, because for every one scientist who believes in global warming, there's 300 that do not. Let's get to the
No, Steve, I'm sorry, your numbers are backwards. For every 9,990 scientists who believe that global climate change is being caused by human beings, there's 5 or 10 who, you know, hacks, basically, who used to also tell us that tobacco doesn't cause lung cancer. They're by and large the same people who are in the employ of the fossil fuel industry or taking money from Koch brothers funded foundations who say, oh, there's no climate change. They are liars. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman program, we're on a quest to find out how conservative and Tea Party political groups contribute to the social welfare of Americans. So we'll see what Steve Sutton, the vice president of the Leadership Institute, has to say. Plus, Tim Carpenter with Progressive Democrats of America is going to stop by and talk about the campaign to educate Congress. And don't forget, democracy begins when you get involved. Check out pdamerica.org or movetoamend.org or free-don.com. Democracy is not a spectator sport. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.